Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Here Be Monsters, the Sunday show with Gwendolyn Berry and Jack Jodell. Oh, my goodness, we lost our caller.
Oh, he's back. Oh, he's there. Good. Okay, great.
No.
Yeah, that's great. Hi, everybody. Hope you're having a great Sunday, and we look forward to a great show today.
Jack, listen. We lost our caller. He's calling back in.
Okay.
Hi, I'm back.
Okay.
Technical difficulties. There you are.
Okay. Hi, Joel.
Our guest is Joseph Holdsworth, who's written a new book. It's called The Devils of Eden. And Joe, I haven't been able to read it yet, but I've talked about it with Bear, with Pinko, or Brad. I don't know if you call him Brad or you call him Bear.
Hey Bear, yes.
And I would really love if you could give us a rundown of what the book. I know it's in novel form, and I do intend to get a copy. Please let me know that. But I'd love for you to give us a synopsis of the book. Tell us what it's about.
Yeah, on a just broad spectrum, I kind of wanted to start off by writing a book. I started off about 2 days after the Bin Laden assassination, and it went, you know, very public, and it was kind of in a reaction to everybody, you know, shifting their focus from Iraq to Afghanistan, and, you know, people had kind of, I guess, generally adopted the idea that maybe we'd made a stake in Iraq and stuff, but people then were kind of still advocating Afghanistan, you know, still like the justified war, and there was a reason for us being there. And I was really kind of just perturbed about how just the general public reacted when Bin Laden was killed. I found it very interesting how it was, you know, played at baseball games. Everything was stopped. You know, we had 60,000 Americans cheering for, you know, what seemed like it was an illegal killing, regardless of,
right,
you know, whatever was behind it. So I basically wanted to start off with just letting people know that everything that happened in Iraq, I mean, aside from maybe the motivations or the projected motivations of us going there, were the same in Afghanistan. All the atrocities that happened to the civilians, people being displaced from their home, people starving, just the general dissidence of the population increasing, was just as prevalent in Afghanistan as it was in Iraq, if not more. So I kind of have
that idea
in mind.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. You're, as I understand it, you're an Iraq veteran, is that correct?
Yeah, I went to Afghanistan and then Iraq twice.
Oh, you did twice. Oh, wow, okay. Okay, and what years did this encompass that you were active over there?
I was in Afghanistan in January of 2003 to around late August of the same year.
Uh-huh.
Then I did my first tour in Iraq the following January in 2004 till early summer, and then I redeployed again in September 2005 till about January 2006, and then I got out about 3 months after I ETS out of the Army.
And where was your original home, sir?
Just outside of Portland, Oregon, Oregon City.
Oh, okay. Okay, very good. Great. And what is your age currently?
28.
Okay, great. Well, that's good to put some of that in perspective so that the listeners understand who they're hearing from today.
Yeah, I've been out for about 7 years now.
Okay.
You were in there as quite a young man. So, Joe, you wrote this in novel form, but Bear tells me that these are experiences that you witnessed or were part of the book itself. Is that pretty good?
Yeah, everything was an actual account of what happened. The chronological order of things that happened and, you know, things that happened in different tours, I kind of included this one just to tell in more of a narrative form and get the point across. And the other thing about me choosing to write it as a novel specifically is like a memoir, a nonfiction, you know, piece on my experiences. And I feel it's kind of biased to write a nonfiction piece on your own experience. It already has you know, a tilt of your own perspective to it. It has your own whatever point you're trying to get across. So just to kind of save any of that confusion, I was just like, I'm going to write a novel that's an autobiographical sense.
Oh, okay.
So what was your major point in writing the book, The Devils of Eden? And where did you get that title from? It's evocative. Where did it come from?
It actually, it kind of came together from a few different places as far as the title goes. We were, I was in the 3rd Battalion of the 504th Infantry Division within the 82nd Airborne. And the 504th Infantry Regiment was dubbed the Devil Brigade by the Nazis in World War II, so we're known as the Devils. So that, along with one of my protagonists in the novel, is named Sergeant Eden, and he's based off my real-life squad leader when I was in Afghanistan. And I just kind of brought it together, and then obviously the connotations with the Bible, I wanted to be present, even though it's not specifically like biblical Eden in that region. I kind of wanted to show that there was a lot of beauty in Afghanistan, same in Iraq, in that whole area. A lot of the distance, a lot of the just dilapidation, it's not from this culture, it's not from these people, it's from our direct influence, the Western world's capitalistic influence, military-industrial complex moving in and putting pressure on these people is what's causing the general malaise in the area. So I wanted to show directly that we were the ones causing that.
Yeah, now, if I may ask, you sound fairly articulate. Were you a college student before going into the service? Or what?
No, I went in right after high school, but I've been going to college since I got out. I'm about 6 months out from graduation.
Well, great. And now you're an accomplished author. That's pretty good. Pretty good progression there, I would say.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Joe, talking about bringing some of the beauty of the land out and some of the reason why it looks so forlorn to us. Could you elaborate a little bit about that? Could you tell us more about how you as an American soldier came to know the people who lived in Iraq and Afghanistan? What your relationship became?
Yeah, I had a real unique experience with having relationships with the local population in a couple forms, especially in Afghanistan. The biggest thing about it in Afghanistan, and I write about it in my book, is when I went over there, you know, the war was still first going on. When I went into Afghanistan, Iraq hadn't even started yet. We hadn't sent any troops in, except for probably clandestine forces. But it wasn't, you know, nothing was being talked about with Iraq. All the focus was on Afghanistan, and it hadn't grown to, like, the complex hadn't really grown to the point it was. You didn't have KBR, you didn't have Brown and Root and all these other industries there.
Right.
A big thing that was different from later on in the war was with the interpreters. Later on in the war, they had the interpreters hired directly from American companies. They would get people who just spoke the language, but, you know, really had no other affiliation with the culture for the most part. When we were initially there, we had to get our interpreters from nearby villages. So we used these guys all the times on the missions and stuff, and formed really close relationships with them. But the unique thing about it was they were actually from whatever area, you know, born and raised their whole lives in whatever area we were doing operations in at that time.
Wow. So when the book begins, you begin as the gung-ho kind of young man just out of school off to find your experiences as a military man. And then by the end of the book, you're a completely different person, I'm assuming, even though I haven't read it.
Yeah. One of the biggest things that I wanted to emphasize with the beginning of the book was that I was that gung-ho kid. You know, I was all about, you know, doing this and, you know, going to combat and proving myself as a man or whatever have you. But it had little to nothing to do with patriotism, national security, or anything like that from my standpoint. And I wanted
just a personal accomplishment, more or less.
Yeah, it was. It was a personal thing. It wasn't for that like nationalistic, like you know, bend or anything. But it was. It was socially induced. You know, it was. It was not about doing this for the country. It was about. Mm-hmm. I was convinced that this is by doing something for the country. That's how you prove yourself as a man. I was more interested in that, and I wasn't really. You know, I wasn't really moved so much by the patriotic sense. It was just like the adventure of it. But our society definitely created within my childhood. You know. Thirst for that kind of an adventure.
Well, your father was a veteran as well, and your uncles and brothers and stuff, or?
No, actually, I don't really have too much of a long line of, military involvement in my family. You know, my dad was in college, didn't have to go to Vietnam. My grandpa was in World War II, but, you know, everybody's grandpa was in World War II, you know, so none of my uncles were in Vietnam. I'm an only child, so I don't have any brothers or sisters in the service or anything. So it was definitely going against the grain for me to enlist to begin with.
Well, Joe, can you tell me what was give me a nutshell of the culture in America that produced the ambition in you? To go, you know, as a young, you were a teenager. To go over there and to, you know, because I sat and played the World War II video with my nephew, who was kind of graphic, you know. And I saw him be very interested in what war might really be like. And I'm wondering, can you tell us what was the stimulation, the inspiration within our culture here?
That's a really good question. Yeah, because again, it wasn't just so much the blind patriotism. Especially at a young age like that, you don't have a sense of national security. You don't really have an established sense of patriotism when you're 17, 18 years old enough to get you behind something like that. So it's something else that does that, and it's a good question to bring that up. For me, I think it was just general culture. I think it started from everything. You know, being in a Boy Scout when you're a kid, you know, it's very, very similar. It's like a paramilitary, you know, type of organization. The school system, everything, competitive sports were another big thing. You know, it gets you used to that and stuff. Everything that you're bombarded on with TV, and not just like mass media as far as like, you know, the news bent about like, oh, you know, we're doing the right thing when we send troops or anything like that. It was more from just, I would say, a pop culture standpoint. I would even bring up a lot of movies that I watched as a kid, you know, and it's interesting because I love, you know, a lot of these old films and, you know, they have their anti-war tilt to them, you know, Apocalypse Now and, Full Metal Jacket and films like that. And the directors who were into that were trying to carry a message that, you know, war is bad and this and that. But somewhere in the middle, to at least younger kids, I think some things got lost in the middle, and they actually motivated people to join the military and be involved in that. It's like you showed it as a bad situation and not exactly as what everybody else projects it as, but you still made it interesting, especially to young kids who want to have an experience that's unlike nobody else. So, like, honestly, watching movies like Platoon, Apocalypse Now and stuff, it gave me an interest in that. You know, being in competitive sports since I was a kid, it was it was just kind of like the next step.
It's another way for you to excel on a different level, I guess, then.
Yeah. And they make that enticing, and they make it a very easy avenue to satisfy that.
Now, what was it that led you to want to write a book about your experience?
I wanted to study English literature, so I've been interested in writing a novel, for a while before I started writing this. And I guess, just really studying culture along with the literature and really learning the ins and outs of, you know, the historical things that I had taken part in and learning the cultural implications and the global implications of all that. And then I just kind of came to the conclusion that I did between what I saw and then the implications globally that, you know, you don't see when you're on the ground. And it seemed like there was really nothing left to do but write the book. You know, it was like a lot of people don't hold this opinion. There aren't a lot of people in my position who, you know, went and did the things I did and then got out and then maybe studied, you know, in school and learned how to write and really articulate what they had experienced and the implications of those experiences.
Joe, can you tell me?
Go ahead.
Did this... become something that you saw as a mistake, or was it something that just actually gave you a greater clarity, and have you become an activist of any kind because of it?
I wouldn't go so far as to say I've become an activist. I become active in learning more about the situations that affect everybody in the world. You know, I try to really become aware of, like, you know, even little choices that I would make as a citizen that may be affecting people on the other side of the globe that, you know, are easily overlooked. So I wouldn't go so far as to say an activist. I'll take writer. You know, I plan on continuing to write about these things, continuing to talk about them, trying to get other people to talk about them is the big thing. But, you know, direct action, I think, is in the discourse at this point.
Yes. Can I ask you a question that might seem rather personal? I know many soldiers, many military personnel do not really talk about it too often, but can you tell us, relate to us, what your first firefight was like over there?
And my first firefight I was involved in, my first few firefights I was involved in, I didn't even get to return fire, actually. I was just fired upon. So already that's a little bit adverse to not just what I think a civilian would think of any firefight, you know, that you know, goes on in combat of thinking, oh, both sides are firing each other, there's people on this line, there's people on this line, and here's the battle. But it wasn't like that a majority of the time. In my first, I don't know, I probably had to get shot at 4 or 5 times before, for the first time, I actually was able to return fire, either from going from, you know, being on a convoy and doing something else and having a couple people take pop shots at us, or, you know, something of the like, to where it's like, you know, not just a standard battle. So at first that was kind of like frustrating, very much frustrating, and it was kind of the idea, the reverse of the idea that I thought it was going to be, you know, me lined up with another, you know, person on the other side and we were going to have at it. It was not like that. You didn't see your enemy a lot of the times, you know.
Right. Did any of your compatriots suffer injury, or did you suffer personal injury in any of your encounters with the enemy?
We lost a couple guys in Afghanistan. My first Iraq tour, we were pretty lucky as far as casualties. My last tour in Iraq, we weren't so lucky in the battalion. We had quite a few casualties. I didn't get wounded badly, but I had a couple of IED attacks on my truck. And the last one, I got injured a little bit, but everybody got out alive, luckily.
Well, thank God for that. That's great. Now, none of your close friends were injured or killed, were they?
Actually, a couple of them. A couple of the people actually depicted in the book were killed.
Okay.
One of the people there, and actually one of the people in two following tours after the tour that I covered in my book.
Oh, okay.
Joseph, can you tell me, did you confirm any kind of a kill over there that you know of?
No, as far as the confirmed kill thing goes, I personally didn't have a confirmed kill. I don't know of too many confirmed kills other than, like, a couple of our scout snipers, I guess, that got them. I don't know how much the military actually tracks confirmed kills now. I kind of speculate on the authenticity of a lot of the confirmed kills that I hear about, you know, some of the spec ops snipers getting and stuff. I think that those are just kind of numbers that the media and the military kind of get together and combine. There isn't a focus on body count and things like that like there was in Vietnam. So from what I saw in my observances and the people around me, I didn't see that the confirmed kill thing was really pertinent.
So that's not something that you came really face-to-face with?
No, I didn't.
Okay. That was, I guess, my ultimate question. I'm going off a couple of notes here from a bear, and he asked me to ask you to tell the story of an unarmed kid incident and what it meant to you and what it means today. Something about an unarmed kid?
Yeah, I can basically just give a rundown of one of actually three similar incidents, but the one that I wrote about in my book. A lot of times when you're out on fire bases, they're just like small little micro versions of large air bases in Afghanistan or in Iraq that have the same things. But anyway, there's usually only about 50 to maybe like 80 personnel out there of infantrymen, a couple medics, you know, some Navy SEALs, Green Berets and stuff like that out there. So a big part of being out there, since you have such small numbers, is doing show of force things. Well, usually you have some kind of indirect fire support there, whether it be 60 millimeter mortars or 81 millimeter mortar systems. And these indirect fire missions, usually out at fire bases, are more often than not demonstrations of the fire base's power and ability. Well, a lot of times when you drop all these rounds and just show everybody around, like, yeah, this is a small fire base, but we have indirect fire support here and we can blow things up, they don't really look at what they're doing as far as their targets go. Like, they're just like, they're like, oh, I'm not firing into the city. I'll just fire off into here where I don't think anything is, and it doesn't show anything on the map. But oftentimes there'll be little villages or just maybe little, you know, conglomerations of like three huts and farmers, you know, families living there and stuff. And one of the incidences in Afghanistan that I write about is when our mortar platoon actually, you know, dropped some indirect fire on a family of about 5-6 people, and everybody was killed except for an unarmed child who actually was able to, like, work his way to the fire base, even though he was wounded by shrapnel. And long story short, people thought that he was an insurgent, even though he was a child and wounded, and he ended up getting shot by one of the units who went out to the fence to recover him.
Wow. How does that affect you? I just wonder, being in all of that, it has to be emotionally, there has to be something you have to learn, something very personal from within that helps you to account for the days and these kinds of episodes. I mean, war itself lends to that, but what was it within you that was the mechanism of change and coping with all of this?
The coping came later on. As far as the change went, it wasn't so much a direct switch. I didn't do a 180 by any means with how I thought about what I was involved in, how I thought about, you know, my global ideology or anything. It was that I just realized that whatever I had thought, whatever I had been told, the institutions that I had believed in growing up and put substance in weren't yielding what they said they were, and they weren't doing what they said they were trying to do. The military wasn't about, you know, a preservation of freedom or, you know, spreading global democracy and equality around the world by any means. It wasn't about that. I didn't know what
it
was about.
What did you consider it to be about?
I would say I've come to the point at this point, I look at the military as very little more than a global police force for a corporate-run government.
Oh,
I mean,
very, very interesting. Okay, good. I'm glad you pointed that out.
I have a question from the chat room for you, Joe. David Williams is in there, and he's asking a pretty important question. Do you feel that Afghanistan is better off or worse after the past decade?
I definitely think it's worse off. I can't speak 100% on it because I wasn't specifically on the ground before our invasion, obviously. They had their problems, obviously, with the Taliban, and I'm not about, you know, a right-wing fascist regime telling people how to live by any means, but I would argue that we've really just replaced the Taliban with a more forceful, bigger, richer army. You can look at numbers with depression, heroin production, and heroin abuse. I think it's probably one of the biggest indicators of our involvement over there and what's happened in the last decade. So, yeah, I would say it's definitely gotten worse.
What was the first year you were in Iraq?
04, January of 04.
So you were over there pretty much at the beginning of things.
for
yeah,
him?
Yeah. I think Iraq had probably been going on maybe 8 months or so when I got there.
Right.
Can I ask you, what was it like getting over there at that time? I mean, we probably were still being seen to a certain degree as, from one faction at least of the country, as those who might be, you know, making a change for the better. Was that still in the air, or was that absolutely not in the air?
Actually, in my first tour in Iraq, there was a semblance of that. It seemed like they were trying to project us as being more of a protective force for the Iraqi people, and we were going to kind of like safeguard, you know, the cities while we cleansed them of, you know, their insurgent populations. But again, the tactics were, I thought, more brutal than they were in Afghanistan as far as just the urban landscape, you know, and the urban population is so much bigger in Afghanistan. The manner in which you do operations when you're tearing ass around there, it displaces and affects people a lot more than it even did in Afghanistan. So I think, yeah, while we went in there at first with the semblance, oh, we're here to help the people, oh, we're here to, you know, help build up your national army, you know, so you can, you know, maintain your independence and, you know, fight off these foreign invaders and deal with all this. And but that really disseminated really quickly among the population because we did so many urban assaults on pretty much any village that we came across.
Joseph, if I could ask real briefly, What kind of right before you were deployed to Iraq, what did the military tell you in terms of what the history of the country or the recent events, or what kind of background did they give? What kind of briefing did they give you?
We got absolutely no cultural briefing whatsoever.
Isn't
we got no historical briefing whatsoever from any official level at all. I would say at best maybe
terrible.
Like. Yeah, at passing, an old first sergeant would talk about, like, oh, you know, the Russians went in there and, you know, got their asses handed to them back then. And, but nothing to fit, not like briefings, no classing, no cultural thing whatsoever. I would say as far as it went was don't pick the poppies and don't, you know, smoke weed. That was pretty much
right.
the briefing that we got.
Oh, nice to send our soldiers off into something completely, completely briefed, isn't it? My God, I'm unbelievable. That's unbelievable.
And, you know, as unbelievable as it is, they didn't care. They didn't care about the history. You know what I mean? They didn't care about the history. They didn't care about the culture.
Average soldier didn't.
The average soldier didn't, but they didn't. Command didn't. I don't think.
Command. Yeah, right. That's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they were all completely ignorant on the history of it and in no position to brief their lower enlisted soldiers on how to deal with a population like that.
Oh, my God. That's abhorrent. That's just terrible.
Well,
that's my opinion.
That makes me wonder all the more about the influence and what the effect was of all the independent contractors over there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the independent contractors, I think, are one of the bigger issues that need to be dealt with from a couple angles. The biggest one is obviously no accountability whatsoever.
Good
point. At
least
with the military, you can have a tribunal. You have the UCMJ, the Universal Code of Military Justice, to go from and everything. So it's like you have a little bit more restrictions, although it's definitely, you know, you're fighting behind the U.S., so a lot of things are covered up. But with these contractors out there, I mean, they're fighting willy-nilly. And the biggest thing is just the logical standpoint of contractors and what they do for a living. These people are war profiteers. They make money. The only way they make money is if there's a war going on. So what is your motivation to do your job, actually, and stop a war? You don't have a motivation. You need it to continue going on in order to feed those companies. And I think that that's a big reason why our military operations are expanding and continue to expand, and we will just continue to invade and continue to occupy because we have so many corporate resources that can get fed into the bills to do that.
It really is criminal in a certain sense, isn't it, Joseph?
Yeah, I agree.
It is horrible.
We are getting a question from the chat room from a lady who's asking, Joe, do you think the role, this is her question, do you think the role of mercenaries and drones are removing humanity from modern warfare? It's a little strange because I don't think there is any humanity in war. But then again, it is a place where humanity shows up the brightest sometimes. So I leave you with a question. Mercenaries, mercs, and drones, are they removing all the rest of humanity from the approach to war?
Or the human contact?
Well, it's a great question, and I agree with you. There isn't humanity in war, but that's the thing with it. It removes the dehumanity in war, conveniently.
Right.
You know, it gives the image that this is easy. At least for guys like me, the infantrymen on the ground, yeah, we do our thing. But I had to learn my lesson. I had to go and shoot at people. I had to go get shot at. I had to see people go down. I wasn't sitting, you know, in some tower in Las Vegas, you know, 50 pounds overweight, chewing bubble gum, and watching video games on one screen and flying a drone and killing people in Saudi Arabia on another.
Right.
So, I mean, it makes it a lot easier. It's like, how easy is it for somebody like that to kill 25 people in a day, whereas an infantryman on the ground, you know about what you're getting involved in. You see the blood, you see the carnage, and you see what war actually is, and it is detestable, and there is very little honor in it, if any.
Right.
And, there is no humanity in it, but when you can distance yourself that far away, anything seems clean, you know.
Boy, yeah, that's a scary thought, isn't it?
Yeah.
The use of drones has become a major part of how we're conducting war over there now, isn't it, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, our president's pretty clever at this point. I mean, I see him running the military with the same vigor and that same expansionistic attitude as our last president did. I think he's a little smarter about it, though. I think he's using his clandestine forces with Delta Force and SEAL Team 6, and then his usage of the drones to get around a lot of the public knowledge about what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah, I think it's real convenient for him to be able to use these forces where nobody really knows about, you know. And
yeah,
just
it's
like
no more honorable, though, is it?
No, it's less. I mean, again, as little honor as there is in any military engagement, once people start exchanging fire, you know, again, like people say, as soon as you, like, you know, took it away from two people fighting with swords, all the honor went out of it. Well, I agree with that, but somewhere in between, at least, is people fighting with rifles. And on the far spectrum is this drone and assassination plots and all, you know,
mercenaries. It's almost become an abstraction, hasn't it?
Well, I think it does more harm than good, and that's the thing. Like, even for their mission, which I don't agree with, it still does more harm than good. It's not getting anything done. But then again, you know, you can argue, is that your mission? Just to run operations and maybe not get anything done, just have continual military operations running. Maybe that is the mission.
Well, you got to keep those war factories humming and profitable, and the profits coming in all the time. At least that's the common generalized opinion. And it's really too bad that we've become the arms merchant of the world, isn't it?
Yeah, I think we sell, what, 85% of the world's arms?
Honest to God, that's just that's terrible.
Joe, I would like to know if you'd give an opinion or give me your take on Private Manning and the WikiLeaks. The court martial right now of Manning and WikiLeaks and its involvement, and whether or not you think WikiLeaks is a vital organization to making us a better species or not, whether you think it's yay or nay. Will you address that?
Yeah, I definitely will. As far as Bradley Manning goes and everything he did, just like I don't want to demonize any one person, because it's not an individual effort, it's not an individual problem by any means. I don't want to elevate or make anybody a hero either, so I won't do that with Bradley Manning. As far as what he did and the process of it and what it exposed, and then more specifically what you were getting at is the value in something like WikiLeaks, I think it's invaluable. I think that you absolutely need something like that. I think with global communications being as conveniently used as they are, I think we're in a unique way to actually combat this, you know, very powerful security state and actually know a little bit. You know, it's like that's our one way of knowing a little bit, peeking behind the clandestine curtain a little bit, and knowing something of what we're involved in and somewhere about where our, you know, 50% of our tax dollars are going. So I think it's absolutely necessary.
Good, good point. I'm glad you made that point.
Do you think there's any ending when you, with your experience of the military and how it performs now alongside these paid troops or actually these mercenaries, and there's been so many problems with it. I mean, you hear about especially with having problems with women trying to get along in their units and mercenaries being a problem there too. There's a lot of different issues, but my question is, do you think that honestly that the kind of warfare that's being polished so well by the Obama administration is what's going to go on in the future? Or do you think that there's a point where people are just going to say enough is enough?
I hope that it's the latter. I hope people say enough is enough. But I think that we have, again, I think we have a clever president. I think that he knows, I think that he knows that he can't go about it the same way our previous president did. I think that that's obvious. And he's clever. He knows the operations. He really got involved with the CIA as soon as he was elected. He really learned the ins and outs of how to use his clandestine operations, how to use Joint Special Operations Command, which is the joint operations command between the military and the CIA, and they just pretty much overpass anything and do whatever they want. He's very, very, very good at using these loopholes, I guess I would say, to make sure that things aren't publicized. I think that'll be the increasing goal. I think the drones makes that, you know, there's another step of it. Mercenaries, it's like, okay, we don't, eventually it's like, okay, maybe have more mercenaries than even United States soldiers. These people have an allegiance only to a paycheck, so as long as you keep paying them, they don't care. Whereas U.S. soldiers, U.S. citizens, after a certain point, will begin to question how much what they're doing has to do with any national security or making their lives better in any way. So,
if only we had access to the tell-all books that we'll see sometime down the line in the next 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Gee, I had a good question. It just slipped right out of my head there. I was going to ask you, Joe, what you thought of the idea of these mercenaries and soldiers and the way they've been manipulated by the government. It comes back to me now. Do you see a crossover effect? Did you see a duplication of some of the strategic maneuverability, let's say, from the White House with the Department of Homeland Security, especially while we were enjoying our, you know, American autumn with the Occupy movement?
Well, yeah, I think it's just an expansion of that. I mean, you know, you see drones being used in combat. Now you have, you know, surveillance drones being flown around for traffic and, you know, the illusion of our safety. You know, it's like, I don't buy any of that. I mean, I think that I consider almost at this point the state military and the state police and the federal military is them not being one entity, but that's what they're moving towards. It's just
They're working together uncomfortably closely, aren't they?
Yeah, it's like, okay, the military, this is the global police to get everybody else to do what they want, and then the state and city police are here to police up the citizens and make sure that they aren't being too dissident against what the man's doing.
Right. Oh, my. It's funny. The longer we go, the more reason to become more cynical that we have, really, when it boils down to it.
Yeah. But the reason not to be cynical is that they're not quite as clever as they think they are. They're not getting away with everything they think they are. If I'm 28 years old and I can figure out what the hell is going on, they're not doing that good of a job. So even though it's I'm cynical about things, every time I learn, you know, a little bit deeper how it goes, I get upset. But also, you know, there's the optimism where it's like, well, you're being sloppy enough that I can figure it out. So it is.
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point.
There's a good point being made by David in the chat room. He's saying Obama's legacy will be how much he expanded and redefined the U.S. military so that its powers can be used in every corner of the world without the domestic scrutiny and debate the Constitution demands. And I think that's the subtle messaging you're giving us, Joe, and a lot of work.
Yeah. He hit that right on, whoever that was that wrote that. I mean, yeah,
David
I can't
Williams.
Say that any better. That's exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you are not going to be able to get away with the scrutiny that you are going to get from the citizenship. You're not going to get people to enlist in the military to do those kinds of operations. You're going to have to give it this projected thing. I mean, look at the new Navy commercial, A Global Force for Good. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, that is. It's pretty outrageous. I got to agree with you.
Well, you always get a good dose of propaganda with military recruitment films, you know.
Yeah. But Obama's doing a really, really good job of taking that back to, oh, we're protecting not just our citizens, but we are ridding the world of terrorism. You know, I think that George Bush, I mean, had very much the same kind of attitude about things, but maybe one of his biggest flaws was he was so, did so much emphasis on just the United States, and he pretty much was like anybody for us or whatever, you know. At least Obama,
too unilateral.
Yeah, exactly. Obama's smart enough to realize, like, I'll get to that same place as George wanted to, but I know how to get there.
Right, yeah, that's a very good point and a very astute observation on your part. I congratulate you for that. That's you've got your mind correct on so many things there. That's great.
Thanks.
Can I ask you, Joe, I imagine you know quite a few vets. What is the consensus by the majority of vets? That just your own personal opinion, I'm not asking you to be the Gallup poll, but what would be your own consensus, you know, of the vets you know and who have come back? How do vets feel about the time they've served over there, what the politics have been, and how they actually are being treated as vets?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say most generally it seems to me that they're trying to duck the issue. They're trying to duck their own experiences somewhat. And I'm not trying to call anybody out or anything. I kind of did the same thing. I think that most of the vets who went there, whether what they say, you know, standing aside, I think most of them realized that what we were doing over there had very little justice to it. And when you work that hard to achieve something, to be an elite infantryman, to be a good soldier, and you think you're going to have honor, you think you're going to have this and do, you know, good things and actually help people, even if it is through a brutal manner, you're thought to think that if you do that, it'll save people in some other way. I think when you go to combat a bunch and see that there, no matter how you cut it, like there's probably no way you actually helped. And yeah, exactly. So I think when you get out as a veteran, it's really hard to accept that. Like, even if you didn't do, like, personal atrocities as a soldier, just being involved in something that had no good to it, actually probably had a very negative end as far as general humanity goes. And I think it's something that you probably just want to ignore. And I think that most soldiers, it seems like at least now, from what I see from a lot of people that I know and served with, they're just more or less choosing to ignore. They're choosing, I guess, to go about it the same way they did was when they were soldiers. You know, like, I was a soldier on the ground. That was my job to do. Not up for me to question it. Even though now they're not soldiers and they're citizens and it is up to them to question it, they are very much choosing not to. And I can kind of see the emotional convenience of doing that.
Sure.
Joe, what as a soldier and also now a civilian and an author and somebody who I imagine you've met. You met our good friend Pinko out on out in the Union lines or the Occupy lines or something out there in Reno.
Yeah, for sure.
I wanted to ask you your personal opinion as the man you are with all the experience you've had. What do you think of how the United States or this administration went after Osama bin Laden and what happened in that whole thing?
I was put off by it. At first, I was put off by the reaction. I mean, I remember, you know, eating with my girlfriend and getting a text message, you know, from one of my other friends about it. And then, you know, going home and watching the news and seeing, you know, them, you know, shutting down, you know, baseball games to have 60,000 people cheer and throw fireworks and this and that. And I just thought, yeah, I mean, we're already having kind of a negative attitude about people's attitude on the war and our involvement there and people's lack of interest to the civilian casualties and stuff. I was just so surprised to see just like the barbarism behind a 21st century, you know, developed nation. You just with 60,000 spectators just cheering, you know, the unlawful killing of somebody regardless.
Well, they've made war into a spectator sport, man. They've so sanitized it and so removed it from the average person on the street that it's become a form of entertainment almost. It's been perverted, really.
Yeah, and it's like, again, you know, you take away the name of the man who the mission, you know, was geared toward, and it's like the reality of the situation is you took a clandestine force, you invaded and went into a country illegally that they didn't know about, and then you invaded a house and shot somebody in their bed with their wife, that's what happened, you know?
Yeah, right.
And then you dumped his body.
Granted,
he was a
heinous man, but that's beside the point.
It's completely beside the point. You know, I mean, the conduct in which we carried that mission out, and then even worse, the attitude in which the population reacted to it was unbelievable.
America's changed so many ways, and not in good ways in many cases, and that's one example of how down a bad road we've gone, I believe.
Yeah.
Well, we're spending a lot of money on war, and the drone war reduces that. It does reduce it kind of significantly, but still we pursue it. And we pursue this destruction that's killing our it's basically killing our food sources and all the other natural resources, but we drop bombs and use drones that have such poisonous things in them. I mean, uranium and phosphorus and all kinds of nasty things. And this stuff, it poisons the ground, too. And so people are unable to grow foods, and it's happening over here from poisons that, you know, Monsanto has used. So my point I'm getting to is that the war that is the, you know, only resolution of the, you know, monotheistic mind that so much of our ocracies and isms are based in. What happens when you have groups of military veterans, mostly, who are saying this isn't working, it doesn't work? I've seen many veterans that, like the group that marched with them in Chicago with the Occupy group and threw their medals back at Congress and said, you know, it's wrong.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, Joe, is this something that would that is going on out there in a sort of a crackling along the lines, you know, the electrical lines crackling with this kind of feeling in ex-military, and because I wonder at it. I see so many veterans more and more that are on the side of, you know, oh, this is wrong. You know, you follow where I'm going?
Yeah, for sure. As far as my personal experience goes with it, I don't know a whole lot of veterans. Most of my friends didn't serve, so I just there isn't a huge population in the city where I live of you know, infantry vets or even veterans that I really know. I mean, I know a couple that I've met through here and stuff, but and the ones that I met are involved in those things. They are involved in active issues, political and social issues, and letting their opinions and letting people know, this is my experience, I've come back, and this is now my opinion, you know, of conglomerating those ideas, and this is what I think about it. And I think that's absolutely necessary. For me personally, I look at it as a duty at this point as a veteran. The reason I feel like I have a duty as a veteran, because I didn't do anything good as a soldier. I didn't help the American citizens as soldiers. I don't deserve respect that I'm given by people for anything I did over there. I didn't save you from getting a terrorist attack. I didn't make your life any better by going over there and fighting in those wars by any means. One thing I can do now, though, whether they agree with me or not, is maybe I can make your life a little bit better by saying these things that I did that were purported to make your life better didn't. So people like me maybe shouldn't be involved in assisting this industrial complex as much as we have been. Without the kids doing it, they wouldn't have anybody to go occupy their countries and steal resources from people. So,
well,
I mean,
kids,
I think,
you know, especially poor kids always end up fighting wars for rich white gentlemen. That's the way things tend to go. Joe, I just want to say here and there right now, what a remarkable young man you are, and I want to ask you to reiterate for the listeners, what is the title of your book? Where can people obtain it? Can they get it on Amazon, or where should they find it? Is it at the corner bookstore? Where can people find your book? And
yeah, it's called The Devils of Eden, and it's an autobiographical novel about my experiences in Afghanistan. You can get it at Amazon, online, in either paperback form
or
Kindle. And, yeah, and then on Barnes & Noble, you can get it on Nook. Hopefully it'll be getting out to, like, stores and stuff pretty soon.
Yeah.
If I get a little bit more publicity, I can get a little bit better release. But right now, yeah, if you go on Amazon.com, you can get it in paperback or Kindle form, or go on Barnes & Noble and get it in Nook.
Well, thank you for that information, and I encourage listeners to avail themselves of this, what appears to be a very, very good book, and a very insightful one as well. So I want to thank you very, very kindly for sharing your insights with us.
The Amazon link has been posted in the chat. And Joe, I have two questions from the chat room from listeners. Lauren wanted me to ask you if you have any plans for a second book. If so, will you continue writing about the character from Devils?
I do have plans for a second book. I'm just in the very beginning stages of kind of mapping that out. It'll be very much like my my Devils book, where it'll be an autobiographical novel based on my experiences. It'll have elements of war, but it'll be much more focused on not just my getting back into society, figuring things out, but I'm going to try to, like, really give an allegorical representation of people trying to find substance, trying to find a sense of self in a confusing, you know, 21st century, fast-paced, globalized world. So it's going to be directly related. Yeah, thank you.
Interesting. I have another question. This is from Radio 70, and he asks, if we ever end up leaving the Middle East, what do you think the attitudes of the Middle Eastern youth growing up in these circumstances will be towards Americans and the Western world?
It's going to be bad. It's going to be real bad. That's the one thing I worry about, regardless of what we really do now, what we're going to do. Like, you know, even if everything happens in the ideal fashion that we're talking about today, and if we were to get out, we have an obligation to the people. And everybody says, like, oh, we can't leave Afghanistan. We have an obligation to the people. We do have an obligation to the people now that we've done that, but it's not through continual military occupation. We need to get our military out, and we need to put aid in. We need to invest in schools for them and hospitals and get them going, because we have dilapidated their society so much. As far as the kids go, it's going to be real bad. We've created and bred a whole new – we basically have made what we made them out to be. We acted like the people in Afghanistan were these, you know, just embedded with terrorism and these just like radical Islamists that hated Americans. They weren't. They were people defending their way of life and and everything that they were trying to sustain. When we came in and stuff, I don't know what their kids' attitudes are going to be. Their kids may actually hate Americans and be right-wing Islamists because we've created an environment to where, how else would you have developed? You know, if I were a kid growing up in Afghanistan, if I were one of those kids when I was doing a raid and pulling, you know, their mom and dad out at 3 o'clock in the morning and they didn't see him for 3 months or maybe never again because they got sent off to some detention camp, what would I do when I grew up and became a vet? I would probably shoot at Americans.
Yeah.
Well, there is some light here at the end of the tunnel. It isn't the oncoming train. Myself, personally, I think borders are one of the reasons we have wars anymore. But here's the thing. This technology, the same technology we're using right now, is a very hopeful tool in creating relationships between us and other people. I mean, I have friends in Iran, and I have friends in Pakistan. People I see face-to-face through Skype or Google Hangout, conversations I have, and it's because of social networking and stuff.
Right.
So, as well as what you say is very true, Joe, there's also the balance of the other side. You know, what there are good things that are happening, and the world is opening up in a really good way. A lot of people think that my friend in Pakistan, for instance, knows that it isn't me, the American who lives in South Florida, who dropped the, you know, who used a drone in her neighborhood that killed somebody she had grown up with. It is our
government and our military.
Yeah, it is our leadership that is responsible and at fault for this greed.
Yeah. Well, and we owe the rest of the global community to let it know if you aren't on the side of our military operations and some of our, you know, government's decisions. It's like, as a global citizen, let other people know, you know what I mean? Don't give American citizenship a bad name. If you want to go against, you know, the American government or some of the, you know, military occupations and stuff that we're involved in, I completely agree. But it's like, yeah, without people speaking out, without people communicating with other cultures and being like, hey, I live here, I'm against what they're doing to you guys, you know, nobody's going to know.
That's a good point, Joel. I'm very impressed with your very accurate viewpoint on what we are doing, what we have done, the dangers involved with all of that, and your ideas for building a better future. I am very impressed with your outlooks on all of those things.
Thank you.
Joe, I have to tell you, Joe, Jack, we're at the end of the hour. And
oh, my.
Joe,
okay.
I really, really thank you very much for joining us today and giving us a heads up on your book, which is called The Devils of Eden. And you can find Joe, Joseph Holsworth, Holsworth. He's over on Facebook, too, folks, so you can find him there. I hope you'll come back and talk with us again, Joe.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Okay.
Joe, I hope you get into a 10th printing and that millions of people read your book and learn from it.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, well,
thanks.
Good luck to you, sir. And let's hear from you again down the line when your second book is completed.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me on the show, guys.
You're very welcome. We are glad to have you, Joe. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I will.
Really appreciate it. And I want to thank all the people in the chat room and our sponsors, Roundtree7.com over at the Commons Project Network. That's the network we're on. So here be monsters for this week. Also, please drop by at daughtersofisis.com. where you can find the fragrant memories of our ancestors. But we are sponsored, the Sunday show, by Roundtree 7. That's the number 7.com. Go on over and take a look. Jack, thank you.
Thank you, Gwen. What a great show. I appreciate it very much. Good luck to Joe and everybody. Everybody have a great progressive week, and keep looking forward.
Well, that's one way to go. You know what the other way to go is?
What's that?
Oh, just take it easy.
Yeah, that's good too.
Joe, thanks a lot for being with us.
Yeah, thanks again for having me, guys. Bye.
Yeah, thank you.
And this is the Sunday Show. Thank you for being with us, and that's all she wrote this week. Bye-bye.
All right, good night, everybody.